2 p.m. at the University Place Hotel and Conference Center, 310 Southwest Lincoln Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Alebrijes, the Milagro Theater annual Día de los Muertos theater production, running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Alebrijes is a family-friendly production of real-life artist and Alebrijes creator Pedro Linares, delves into his world and fictionalizes it to create this Día de los Muertos story. Full of mythical creatures, psychedelic jungles, song, dance, and larger-than-life puppetry. Again, that's Alebrijes, the Milagro Theater annual Día de los Muertos theater production, running weekly on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sundays until November 11th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to community-supported KBOO Portland. Wednesday morning talk show is next.
There's a new sun rising up angry in the sky. There's a new voice crying for not afraid to die. Let the old world make believe it's blind and deaf and dumb, but nothing can change the shape of things to come. There are changes.
Yeah, all right. Shape of things to come. That song has no particular significance, although I guess you could read into it. It is simply a promo for the KBOO film tonight, Wild in the Streets, at the Hollywood Theater over there on Northeast Sandy in the Hollywood District. Fancy that. At 7:30 tonight. So, yeah, kind of a wild and wacky film. It's from 1968. It's a long series of... celebrations for our 50th birthday here at KBOO. Yay. And yeah, if, I don't know if you've been listening to the promos. It's allegedly there's a hippie fascist takeover in the movie, which is strangely ironic in these times. I guess that's what the right wing, they're still kind of accusing of that. You know, they say, you know, both sides are at fault, or you all are the real fascists. That's what the Patriot Prayer people say. Anyway, it's they want to. The film was all about. I guess they get the voting age lowered to 14. Or no, that's the big rallying cry of the movie is lower the voting age to 14. Anyway, there's a general youth insurrection in the movie, which I'm all for. I think that may be our only hope. So let's see. Popular rock singer and aspiring revolutionary Max Frost was born Max Jacob Flatow Jr. His first public act of violence was blowing up his family's new car. His band, the Troopers, lived together with him. Blah, 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 blah. When Max is asked to sing at a televised political rally by Kennedy-esque Senate candidate Johnny Fergus, who was running on a platform to lower the voting age from 21 to 18, he and the Troopers appear, but Max stuns everyone by calling instead for the voting age to become 14, then finishes the show with an improvised song, 14 or Fight, which is on this album I just played that from, Wild in the Streets, which actually got to number 12 on the Billboard charts, and a call for demonstration. Anyway, that kind of led to this massive insurrection. Only in 1968 could such a film be made, and it is at the Hollywood Theater tonight at 7:30. Come out and join in with other KBOO listeners and support the station and watch a wild and wacky film. That's that. I'm going to be opening up the phone lines right off the bat. Anybody who wants to talk about anything about the election yesterday. Once every couple years, this show comes right after election day, and I guess I feel, I don't know, it seems like something to talk about. So I got a few things to read as well before I wait for people to call in at 503-231-8187. I'm sure everybody has their own high points, low points, reasons why they voted, maybe reasons why you didn't vote, anything regarding elections, electoral politics, both general and specific, are on the table. 503-231-8187. So here, exclusive poll, only half of Americans have faith in democracy. Just 51% of Americans said they have faith in the country's democracy, and 37% say they have lost faith in democracy, according to a new Axios SurveyMonkey poll conducted in late October. Since October 2016, just before the last presidential election, SurveyMonkey has tracked Americans' views toward American democracy. Just before heading the polls in 2016, 52% of voters had faith in democracy. That number grew from pre-election numbers. 1 year ago, in October 2017, faith in democracy dropped by 7 percentage points. SurveyMonkey also found that half the country believes America is more divided today than ever before. I wonder if the other half doesn't believe that. Anyway, it goes on. Do you have faith in democracy? I did a show last week on totalitarian capitalism, basically saying that capitalism essentially trumps democracy when the conditions for making sufficient profits in the eyes of those who have the ability to make the profits are no longer there, or the system has, because of its own internal dynamics or other factors, loses the ability both to put, you know, large numbers of people to work so they remain relatively content and non-insurrectional. And as I said, the oligarchs are able to keep making their profits. When those conditions arise, then democracy just goes out the window. In fact, you know, capitalism started under monarchical regimes, so it was basically born in authoritarianism. Of course, capitalism really grew out of the invasion of the Americas, which basically put a lot of metal currency, gold, silver, into the coffers of the indebted European monarchs, kind of indebted from long inter-family, inter-royal struggles and wars. And basically the whole opening up of first vast new resources and then new, quote, markets basically established the capitalist system, and a lot of it had to do, of course, with the slave trade. The Bank of England kind of rose upon the back of slavery. Many banking institutions, if you look at their origins in the United States and England, have their origins in slavery. And of course, the expropriation of all the vast resources of all the people and ecosystems, but specifically people who lived in these areas. So yeah, capitalism basically is a system that was never democratic, never intended to be democratic. It was just a transition from the feudal system, creating a whole new class of elites in the world. And it has just grown in its power, extent, and influence ever since. And the democracies, in a way, were, you know, a reaction to the tensions between the older nobility and the rising bourgeoisie, and et cetera. We could go on and on. It looks like we already have some callers. Okay, let's go right off to Joe. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to make one comment about the electoral electoral process here in Oregon, and I gather apparently several other states, I'm not sure how many, they have barcodes all over the ballots. They know exactly who's voting how on what. The ballots are individually barcoded in most of Oregon now. I think there were six counties at least that I knew of where they know this is your ballot, this is how you voted, and that, you know, even becomes more of a concern. First of all, it's against state law. The statute says we have the right to a secret ballot. Second of all, with all the hacking of the electoral systems, it's like giving away information that I really don't want them to have. I find it rather intimidating.
Okay.
Sue the Secretary of State and make them abide by the law.
Have you heard of any particular abuses of this fact?
Any what of it?
Abuses. You're saying it exists, but have you heard of anything coming of the fact that...
Well, Oregon State, the state of Oregon just said that somebody had hacked into the election system and all they got was publicly available data here just a few weeks ago, it seemed like, maybe a month ago. But somewhere in the system is exactly how everybody voted on every issue.
Okay.
And that's against the law. And I really wish they'd quit putting the barcodes on the ballots.
Well,
just a plain paper ballot with the measures on it or the candidates, whatever.
Well, I plead complete ignorance about that. I don't know what the reason for it is. I don't know what the implications are, but I appreciate your flagging that.
I've done quite a bit. This has been going on for about 6 or 8 years now. They've given me all kinds of excuses from county clerks to, you know, it's just, we need it so we know which precinct it goes to and da-da-da-da-da, but every ballot is unique and different and identifiable. It has your name and address all over it, so it's like, it's not a secret ballot.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling on that. If anybody else has any further information, please call 503-231-8187, and let's go to Camilo on the next line. You are on the air.
Good morning. How are you? I'm really excited today. We've just had a sweep in Oregon. We've defeated all the measures of the reactionary to change the values that we believe in, and I think among them was particularly strong was the votes in Portland for campaign reform, finance reform, and for the Portland Clean Energy Initiative. And I just want to say about the Portland Clean Energy Initiative that it has been an amazing run that gathered steam, that mobilized a lot of people, and it was a really sweet victory. I mean, we got over 63%.
No, that's really remarkable. I was impressed. I figured it would win. But I really definitely didn't think it was going to get that big a margin.
Well, if you think that was good, take a look at the margin of the campaign finance reform, 26-200. I think that was 80-something percent.
Really?
So something is going on here that has to be fulfilled. And I just want to make comments about what we need to do now. I think we need to analyze our success, put it in writing, make it available for other people other cities who want to follow in this way, and also as a guide to how we are going to assure that these policies that we voted in are implemented according to our intentions. And then finally, we have to work hard to keep this coalition together. There's going to be a little fall off after the election, but a lot of people were knocking on a lot of doors and making a lot of phone calls in the past month, and we've got to get together. And I know there's several organizations that are meeting to work on this, such as the Portland Metro People's Coalition. We gotta organize ourselves to continue this mobilization and realize the power that we have made available to us for the benefit of these communities that we represent.
Yeah, I'd like to see it go in a much, you know, even stronger, possibly more radical direction. It'd be kind of cool. I guess the only thing, you know, I think maybe some people have perceived me as being perhaps critical of that measure. My criticisms are not specifically of the measure. My criticisms are of the whole climate movement in general, you know, in relationship to the actual speed at which climate change is happening, and my perception that basically nothing that I see happening, including that measure, is really up to the task of taking on the accelerating speed of climate changes going on. So I guess my question is, do you think that the coalition that came together will actually has the potential to move in the kind of direction that will possibly be able to take on the sorts of approaches and campaigns and whatever that would accelerate our ability to challenge the accelerating climate change?
Well, I think what the key is to determine how people power can overcome monetary corporate power. And if you compare what happened in Washington and in Oregon, I think there's a lesson. In order for
but this was just Portland. This was just Portland, though, the clean energy, not statewide,
right,
which might make a big difference.
But we've got a carbon tax coming up in the next session here in Oregon.
Okay.
And we need to build a power that's going to assure that gets passed. I mean, that not just that it gets passed, but it even gets introduced into the legislature. So developing that kind of power and showing that we have the ability to organize and to resist the huge amounts of money that are being spent by corporate interests will, I'm sure, support similar movements around the country. And I'm sure this is going to happen with the Portland Clean Energy Initiative. You're going to see 26 other cities implement a policy like this in the next couple of years.
Uh-huh. There's already that many cities that are actively talking about it?
Yeah.
Right on. Well, we'll see what happens. I'm definitely I voted for it, you know, to set the record straight, as if anybody cares. I voted, you know. I voted for Kate Brown. I voted
but,
for...
But I think to take your point about this, I see that what you're saying is a warning to us that we have to keep at this. We have to keep working. It's not going to happen if we don't put our shoulders to the wheel now.
Well, I guess in private conversations and even public questions at certain events, I have posed the question, you know, about the actual... what people actually know about what's going on with climate change. I find that there's a resistance to actually looking at the real time, what's really happening. I think we tend to get somewhat lost in doing things because they need to be done, and there's nothing wrong with that. But are they actually adequate to the task at hand? And, you know, it's a very difficult. I don't pretend to have the answer, but I just think that people get... We get so caught up in the functionality of things, of, you know, doing things, and we sometimes lose what's actually happening and whether what we're doing is actually has the ability to actually confront it.
Well, I agree with you about this, and I think that you know, we don't have that ability now, but I think the important thing to realize is that what we can do is try to establish some degree of justice, some degree of environmental justice, economic justice, as we move towards trying to do something about climate change on a global scale.
So do you think, how quickly, what's the modality of this measure? How quickly do you think it's going to be, how long do you think it's going to take to really get the nuts and bolts? You know,
I think it's going to take at least a year. Uh-huh. I think there's going to be a period of ruled writing for the measure to be guided by. And I think that one of the things that we all need to be involved with is that process and to have representation on how that process moves forward.
All right. Well, thanks again, as usual, Camille. Always a pleasure to talk to you. And definitely, you know, congratulations. That was a lot of work by a hell of a lot of people. And so I'm glad it passed. I'm probably maybe even more glad for the people who did the work, because I wasn't involved, although as I said, I did vote for it. So thanks again, Camilo. And we'll be following this, of course. Let's see. Up next is Joe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Regarding the barcodes on the ballots, the way to prove or disprove this Patriot Prayer Idiot's allegations is to simply go to your neighbor and compare your two ballots, not your envelopes, just your ballots, and you'll find out that the barcodes are identical. You cannot distinguish your neighbor's ballot from your own if the barcode is exactly the same.
You know, I'm so glad you called in, because I personally paid no attention to the barcode thing. And so, you know, if someone calls in with a comment, I'm willing to listen to them. But I appreciate your clarifying that.
The envelope, on the other hand, does have your unique barcode. But that's only to keep track of who voted and who didn't. Okay? It simply says that, yeah, this person voted. But the envelope inside that contains the actual ballot, there's no identification on that. And there's the barcode that's inside on the ballot itself is not unique to the individual voter.
And
it's for the whole precinct.
Uh-huh. Right on. I just would say that, you know, alleging that caller was actually involved with Patriot Prayer, I think that might be a little strong.
Well, these folks brought this up back in 2016. It was all over the internet.
Oh, okay. I missed that.
The conservatives picked up on it, and it was one of their arguments for electronic voting. That's the rationale behind their thinking.
All right. I am so glad you called. I
do have one more thing. It deals with the issue that you just talked about with the oil and the taxes and all that stuff in Washington.
Uh-huh.
I voted for 1631, but I am disappointed that in the actual proposed law itself, they exempted the exported fuels, the exported oils, the exported coals, the exported natural gas. Okay? Why would they exempt that? There is more fuel being exported from the state of Washington than is used in the state of Washington. Every day in the United States, they export 2.5 million barrels of oil at 42 gallons per barrel from domestically extracted fracked oil sources. That's just the oil. Okay? That's 20% of the oil that's used. They lost their argument against the oil companies who said, this tax is going to cost everybody a whole bunch of money. Well, the principle behind conservative free marketism has always been to determine cost demand ratio. If you have supply demand ratio and you skew the supply by shipping the supply offshore, you're raising the price of everything, not just the fuel, but everything that depends on the fuel. So when you export that kind of stuff and your goal is supposed to be to stop burning this, you know what's going offshore is going to be burned. Why exempt it?
Fair enough. That's a point well taken, and appreciate your calling in with that as well, especially the thing about the envelopes. Got to nip these things in the bud. I certainly didn't want to let that slip through without more of a comment, since I certainly didn't know what was going on. So thank you for calling, Joe. We have a Edie up next, but I saw on our board here that there was a Joe J.O. who had called in. I don't know if they got confused that I went to a different Joe, but if you want to call back, please do. But in the meantime, let's go to Edie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Paul. I also want people to think what I think and do what I want them to do in the time frame and to understand the urgency.
Wait a second. Are you saying that I want people to think what I think and do what I want? Is that what you're saying?
I do.
Oh, in what?
And what, that it's more important
But what did I say to make you think that? What did I say to make you think that?
It's more important for us to have the progress in the right direction, because if people realize how scary, sad, and fast we're having feedback loops, and how it seems like we're doomed, instead of them working harder and better and smarter to be more effective, a lot of folks give up hope and fight among themselves or get depressed. And so even if I'm going to encourage a little bit more optimism in others than I feel, it's more productive for folks to do what they can do, at least have the joy and the peace of mind of integrity of acting in concert with their values. And so I used to really focus on how quickly things are changing and how horrific. I've been doing this for over half a century. And now I'm letting go of some of what, having them know how bad the radiation is, or how bad some government stuff is, or how fast things are happening. And instead, because that was kind of productive, just like the old days when we were trying to get folks to clean their teeth, we would show them these horrific mouths that didn't do anything, and that didn't work. But by talking about being sexy and a little bit of progress, they were a lot better at brushing their teeth. So I've learned to let go of my fear and trying to get others to see the urgency of how quickly the feedback, how horrific, how many things are stacked against us, what awful plans are being done, but instead focus on what progress we can make and just keep it up, and that becomes so satisfying and rewarding that we do a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, and encourage that progress. And I find that it really is much more effective, and the process in the community building is much stronger, and our mental health and our sustainability is much stronger.
Well, I appreciate all that, but I do take issue with your saying that I want people to think what I think and do what I want them to do, because I actually made no suggestions about what people should do. In fact, I am somewhat at a loss, and I think I somewhat disagree with your take on it. And I know we're kind of getting back. I think I skewed this direction in the direction of climate change. Once again, there's lots of other interesting things, the election, but just to stay on this point is, no, my point is that actually is the problem is a lot of the people that actually have more power to do things, you know, I'm talking about large organizations, whether they're environmental organizations or other, there's a lot of organizational power out there that if it all kind of worked together could accomplish a lot. And I think in a small way, what happened in Portland is exactly what I would like to see happen on a larger scale, and is a very positive thing. I have nothing bad to say about it. My issue is that people are basing their decisions on what sort of policies to recommend and what sort of campaigns to do on a flawed reading of what's actually going on. I think we actually need to understand what's actually going on in as much in real time as possible in order to motivate ourselves, you know, even at the, you know, even those inner organizations, those people should be forthrightly confronting the reality of what's going on and not shying away. And instead, I think they have an aversion to actually look at what's going on because it challenges, I think it fundamentally, my feeling is it fundamentally challenges our kind of our ego sense and our sort of deep-seated, often unconscious belief that progress, that this way of life is okay. No, it's like we have to actually look at the underlying assumptions that created this whole situation to begin with. I think there's a denial. There's denial mechanisms at work at various stages. And I'm not saying, you know, doom and gloom is the way to motivate people. I'm saying we need to understand what's actually going on with climate change. And I think very few people seem to be really willing to confront that.
Yeah, and I understand that. And that's where I've been coming from as a scientist, as a prophet. Not many people really want to hear me because I'm saying inconvenient truths with an intensity and an urgency and a demand. And I always want to know, not just go after the symptoms, but go into the underlying causes. And so you and I, you know, we have a lot of affinity in that. I just have had to learn that
we can move forward with these incredible coalitions, Defend Oregon, Portland Metro People's Coalition, SEIU. I mean, we had a lot of folks working together who weren't necessarily aware of their issues or hadn't talked to other people from other life experiences, but started coming together little bit by little bit, and they didn't have to all have my political analysis or spirituality or urgency or intensity for us to make progress, and they didn't have to be right on everything. I didn't have to be right on everything, but we could still learn from each other and we could still make progress.
Okay,
so
Edie, we got a lot of people waiting.
All different approaches.
Okay. No, I fully appreciate that. I'm so glad you were involved. I'm so glad lots of other people involved. I should be chastened a little bit for, you know, whatever doubts I might have had. And so, hey, power to the Clean Energy Initiative and to it going forward and gaining steam and moving ahead. So thank you for calling, Edie. And we've got a couple other callers waiting in line. We got Harry up next. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. My first remark is to your first caller, Joe, and he was wondering why the barcodes are different on the ballot.
Yeah, we've actually had a response already, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Oh, you did? Okay, I'm sorry. I must have missed it because, anyway, so is because, you know, if you're in a each ballot is different for what I vote for. Where I live, like I live in out in Southeast Portland, I'm in the Centennial School District, so I will get the ballot for that, not for something else. So it describes it. That's why they have to keep track this way. And also, what I love mail-in ballots, because if there's a recall, all they have to do is put the ballots back into the machine again.
Yeah. In fact, the person who responded to that said that actually that meme, that idea. Of that they're using those barcodes for nefarious, they, whoever they are, for nefarious purposes, said that was like taken up in couple years ago as a way to actually discredit paper mail-in ballots, paper ballots, to go to electronic. So yeah, obviously there's probably more nefarious going on the people who are putting that out. But I hear that, you know, even mail-in ballot is actually a lot cheaper than other. And so it seems like there's really not too many strikes against it, actually. And I understand there are other states that are picking up, that have been studying the Oregon model and are moving more towards that.
I hope they do, because it makes things so much easier. And undoing it. So, I mean, I could sit down at my dining room table and do my ballot and mail it and do it early and don't have to worry about the rush or going, you know, voting physically. So it makes things so much easier.
You know, the one issue I thought with it is I wonder about houseless people, about how they are able to negotiate that, if they are. I suspect a lot of houseless people are not able to vote because they're just outside the system, and not just because
they don't have an address.
Well, they don't have I think there's probably ways around that, but you have to be somewhat in the system in order to negotiate that to begin with. Yeah.
Yeah. You also have to remember all those houseless people out there. There's millions of them. All of them are not considered unemployed. They're not on statistics. You have to be getting unemployment to be listed as unemployed. So there's millions not. So they're just out of the system completely, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, we're talking about the election.
Mm-hmm.
First, I'm so happy that Joanne Hardesty won.
Mm-hmm.
And and she also mentioned she will still be doing her show. So do you know?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. What's that?
Huh?
I was wondering about that because I know she's been on hiatus. And that'll be interesting.
She mentioned that she will be doing her show also maybe once a month or something, but she still will be doing it.
So okay.
This will be interesting to see what happens. But also, your opening song about the
shape of things to come.
Yeah, about you mentioned about the right to vote from 21 to 18. And that was the last time that the U.S. Constitution was changed was in 1970, giving the 18-year-old the vote. That's the last amendment that we ever had in the Constitution.
Yep, since the Equal Rights Amendment just failed by a whisker, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true, and it's something that I think the Me Too movement should start thinking about getting into is bringing back the Equal Rights Amendment. Since there's a lot more women in Congress now, it should you know, go, fly right through, you know. So they need to redo it.
All right.
I know there's a time limit on it, but, you know. But anyway, that's all I have.
Okay, well, thank you, Harry, as always. We're talking about the elections. Did you vote? Did you not vote? What do you? What are some bright spots? What are some sad spots? One of my sad spots is that the fracking ban in Colorado went down. That was kind of sad. Of course, the other one, which was also supported by the fossil fuel industry, also went down. So that's good. But God, it would have been nice to see a statewide ban on fracking. Oh well. Two Native American women, Congress people. I understand that's big. There's a lot more women coming in to the House of Representatives. That could make things a lot more interesting and hopefully temper. I guess a lot of what temper the foulocracy at in charge there with the foulocrat number one there. So the idea that this House of new democratically led House of Representatives will reinstill checks and balances in the system. That seems to be what a lot of people are writing and talking about. What do you think about that? That's one subject. We've got about 20 minutes left to go, and Warren is up next in queue. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, so part of what I have to say is definitely about what the first caller said, and I had called the elections office before, and I couldn't remember what their response was, so I called them again, and that is what the guy had said it was about just keeping track of the districts. I have to say, the reason that I asked the question originally was because, you know, I was a little bit paranoid, worried about them tracking my vote and what I might think and the whole kind of, I guess,
oops, we lost Warren. Well,
Hello?
Okay, I guess that was our, unfortunately, our board op made a little boo-boo, but that's okay. We've actually, that's the fourth caller that's talked about that subject. I think we've talked about that enough. Maybe Warren had some other things to say, but let's go to our next caller. Is this Juan? Whoops. I guess not. Let's go to Harry number two, perhaps. Hello? It's Mitch. Go ahead, Mitch.
You can hear me, yes.
Yep.
I was a bit further back in line, but these people did get bumped. Well, I wanted to raise a point. So far, the calls and the discussions have been very enlightening, and I like this level of discussion, and I hope to keep it at this level. But there was a race, Paul, on the East Coast in Virginia in which the sister-in-law, and I don't mean to reduce her professional career to being the sister-in-law of progressive journalist Alexander Coburn, but Leslie Coburn, a great journalist in her own right, one of the few progressive journalists who was writing about subjects in the 1970s and 80s when there was a vital alternative press. She could have remained in the alternative press, but she wound up doing some amazing documentaries for network news television before it all went to private interest rather than public interest driven. And Leslie Coburn ran for office in Virginia and lost. And I have to say that I have been attempting to be a progressive member of the Jewish diaspora community in America, which has caused a lot of conflict with people that will cover up some of the more nefarious policies of the Israeli government. Even though we support the state of Israel, we are critical of Israel. And Leslie Coburn was targeted by my community, character assassination-wise, for a book that she wrote 27 years ago about the global arms trade. And her best contacts in that book It's not just her book. She wrote it with her husband, Patrick Coburn, who's one of the foremost authorities on global arms trading. That book, Dangerous Liaison, 27 years ago, has turned out to be the blueprint for where we are now, given that both America and Israel have been arming the Saudis in the ongoing genocide in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
And she was targeted by my community character assassination, and my community was the assassin of that character assassination. So,
wait a second, are you saying she was targeted 27 years ago?
No, she was targeted during the election.
So you think that
for office after a distinguished 30-year career in network journalism, and was still targeted and lost because of the hysteria raised about her being anti-Semitic rather than, I won't even say she's anti-Zionist, because I read her book, I wrote about her book in the alternative press 27 years ago, and her best contacts were Israeli generals who thought their own government was on the wrong track.
Wow.
So I'm sorry.
So they've got long memories.
The Consortium News, that is run by Robert Parry's son now, Robert Parry, the great journalistic hero. Sometimes Dennis Bernstein at KPFA will source Consortium News. They're based in Virginia. I don't know why they didn't present any information for the months leading up to this, where Leslie Coburn was being targeted as anti-Semitic, why this hasn't been an issue for the progressive community to rise up. And I think we need to do a post-mortem of people like Leslie who were targeted and lost for the wrong reasons. We shouldn't just be celebrating. God bless Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but she's young, she's inexperienced, and someone like Leslie Coburn would have been very valuable in Congress. And we need her to continue being politically active and not just slink away now because she was targeted as an anti-Semite.
Well, maybe I should track her down and have her on my show. That would be interesting.
Please invite locally, well, not locally, they're in Northern California, but at one time, Jeffrey St. Clair, the editor of Counterpunch, was publishing out of Portland. You can call these people up and have them tell Leslie's side of the story, or just have Leslie tell her own side of the story.
Okay. Well, thank you for that.
I remember going to bookstores when she and her husband, Patrick Coburn, were touring after Dangerous Liaison came out, and the bookstore discussions were packed and very illuminating. And she needs to be out there. She can't be someone who's going to be a victim of character assassination.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. That's an important piece. Staying with the East Coast, and it's we've got some lines open, 503-231-8187. I was wondering about this. A big story that's probably not going to get enough attention, of course, is the massive voter suppression, various kinds of electoral manipulation, possibly outright tampering. Who knows? There's certainly allegations of the easy ability to hack some of these electronic voting machines. We know that there's vast voter suppression. What Amy Goodman talked about in Democracy Now!, the passage of that initiative in Florida to finally enfranchise most convicted felons is one bright light, along with some of the local stuff we're talking about and some of the congressional races that we're talking about. But this whole issue of voter suppression, you know, from gerrymandering on to all the other forms of manipulation that Greg Palast and others talk about. So the Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp race for governor of Georgia, she is not conceding. I think last I saw, she was still down by 3 points, 51-48, with, you know, 97% or something counted. But there's a lot of absentee ballots, a lot of provisional ballots, those that people cast when there's some doubt at the polling place, and they just go ahead and put in the provisional ballot and hopefully gets approved later. I just wonder, and I kind of looked up briefly, didn't really get a chance to get into it, the law around recounts, because it sounds like she's sort of either saying or dancing around the possibility of a recount. What I wonder is if this thing is so close, gets really close, and if she does end up even losing, what the recourses are towards these possible you know, these allegations of electoral manipulation. Has anyone ever? I saw only one case, and this is, you know, Wikipedia, that Bill Stinson won an election based on fraudulent absentee ballots in Pennsylvania. The courts ruled that his opponent be seated, and this was state senate, you know, which is not a governorship of a big state like Georgia. You know, we know what happened with the Al Gore George Bush election, where basically the Supreme Court decided the election, and a lot of people thought that Al Gore didn't really pursue it far enough. I wonder what, you know, what the recourses are, what Stacey Abrams is going to do. That's one thing I'm looking at. Okay, we've got Juan. Juan, go ahead. You are on the air.
Hi. I'm appreciative of the fact that everybody's turned out to vote. In fact, I voted for the first time with my wife. I said, baby, help me with this, and she did. We both got our best. Because, you know, what Trump, his attitudes and stuff were just too extreme. And I knew America.
Oops. Lost Juan. I don't know what happened with that. We lost our other caller, too. I thought we had another caller. Oh, well. Okay, we got sorry, I was just having a private conversation with my board op there. We've got a clean slate, 503-231-8187. Juan, please call back if you want to get on the, the sound quality wasn't too great with your phone, so maybe you could do something to change that. But we got a clean slate here now, 503-231-8187. As I said, I'm looking at that. I'm looking at some way to challenge. I mean, are the Democrats, now that they've, you know, got a decent margin in the House, are they going to go after voter suppression? I mean, are they going to go after, you know, Trump in terms of some of these investigations? They're all kind of minimizing this idea of impeachment. You know, they don't want to make that a big issue. They didn't want to make it a big issue in the campaign. I'm talking about they in general, the more the establishment Democrats. But in general, I think that was true. Let's see. I've got some other articles here. The 2018 election is a referendum on American democracy from just a couple days ago. Trump has been eroding important institutions, and midterms could reverse some of the damage. And I just want to, there's one paragraph that struck my attention, but perhaps the most important impact on American democracy will be the lessons the election imparts on Trump's fellow Republicans. Democrats taking back the House, likely this scenario according to the polls, and it has come to pass, could leave Republicans with a sense that he's vulnerable and that they can afford to challenge him and join in investigations, reducing Trump-associated backsliding. Conversely, a Republican win could reinforce the idea that white identity politics works and the party can pursue voter suppression and other anti-democratic moves and be rewarded for it. Well, hopefully, that's the hope. That's been beaten back. Got another article that says that Trump is going to escalate his attacks on American democracy post-election, no matter who wins, by Evan McMullen. That came out yesterday, I believe. And so, yeah, there's differing interpretations of what this is going to mean, how the Democrats, you know, is the so-called progressive or left wing of the Democratic Party going to be emboldened? Are they going to be given more space by the old guard? Let's see what Tom has to think about these or other topics. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Tom with Healthcare for All Oregon, and I'm a nurse. I want to go back to, Paul, what you were saying about the rapidity at which we need to address the climate issue. I like to use the example of somebody that's down in the street, maybe had a heart attack, and you say, well, I'm going to pump this heart at 60 beats per minute, or I'm going to get to them 10 minutes later. Well, it's too late. If we don't go harder and faster, it will not work. So the idea that you keep bringing this up is very essential. It's going to take several years, even if we pass the Clean Energy Jobs Bill at the state, for that to be implemented. You were asking about that. And so I want to just support you in that area. The other thing I want to do bring up, though, is it's time to hold all these people. People worked very hard and decided to do the voting they did around these electeds. it's now for time for accountability, and people should be in their ears on the various issues. Kate Brown shouted out campaign finance reform at the top of her agenda, which is very, you know, which is essential. Everybody's calling for health care, you know, single payer movement, and encourage people to call their legislatures, and all these people that were running on this issue need to put up the pressure and keep things going.
Hold their feet to the fire. Okay.
That's my comments.
No, and I appreciate your comment, that analogy you made. I've heard some other analogies, but that's a, you know, that puts it in stark relief when you.
Well, they used to put it, used to say 80, you know, 80 compressions, and now they're just saying like 100 to 120. And they used to say, well, be careful, don't break the ribs. And now they say, don't worry about breaking the ribs. You just got to save the patient. And so those are some of the changes that have occurred, you know, over time, right? So, you know, I think the issue, which I didn't bring up, which is the idea of break the ribs to save the patient, is was really a part of that message.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate that. And anyone else wants to join in this electoral conversation, 503-231-8187. I don't know if anybody has heard anything new about that Stacey Abrams. You know, here, you know, I think in some ways the election kind of reinforced this sort of idea of the Portland or Oregon bubble, you know, that we passed all these progressive measures. We beat back a lot of the right-wing threats. And so we're, you know, in a relatively good position, but there's a lot of states, for example, that have incredible increasing restrictions on abortion, for example. So if you're a woman who is facing those things and you live in Oregon, you can still get public funding for abortion. It's still much more widely available, but that certainly isn't true in a lot of places. But we've got another caller. Go ahead, Ross. You are on the air. Hello?
I share the enthusiasm and the joy of what happened yesterday. To me, it was a surprise, and especially the magnitude of the progressive win yesterday is a surprise. Hello?
Yep.
Am I here?
We heard everything.
Yeah, and what I'm thinking, and this is a good moment to just get started on bringing all this great cooperative energy together. And I think the best example of the collaboration is in the Clean Energy Fund that brought such a fabulous mix of we'll say almost different interest groups together in one very practical and radical action. And so I want to get this started, especially find ways to bring the same kind of coalition together at the neighborhood level.
Uh-huh.
And I'm working in the Woodlawn neighborhood, and I'd sure like to hook up with people who are part of all these different people and do our coalition work, follow through with something in the neighborhood, and maybe do some of the put to work some of the things that the Clean Energy Fund can support.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to share that, and if anybody were interested for my neighborhood in Woodlawn, I don't know if I could put my phone number out on the air.
I think that's a call that's entirely up to you.
Okay. Well, listen, if anybody in Woodlawn is part of that coalition has been working on that, I'd like to put that to work here along with fighting gentrification. 503-875-1362. 503-875-1362.
And that's Ross in the Woodlawn neighborhood. You know, that's an interesting thing you bring up. I think that's something that you know, there's the official neighborhood associations, and there's, you know, some people, you know, progressives, leftists, whatever, who've found that a good arena to work in, so that they find like-minded people. Some of the neighborhood associations may be more sort of business interest dominated. And it's a, you know, it's a thing you have to kind of to work at. But what you're talking about is more just a direct citizen, person to person.
Yes, but each one neighborhood is different, and the experiences change over time, and there's a lot of possibilities. and neighborhood action does not have to be restricted to your neighborhood association. But I'm proud to say that Woodlawn Neighborhood Association is a signer as part of the coalition for the free, Clean Energy Fund.
Uh-huh.
And
oh, good.
So I think we can do something, but I'm going to, if I have time, I'll tell a quick story. I was trying to get, my wife and I live in this neighborhood, and one day about 5 years ago, somebody from Sierra Club came by, and they wanted to sign us up to be supportive of some movement, and so we'd agreed to pay $10 a month. And a little bit later, somebody from the, it was the Urban League came by, and they had another campaign, and they wanted our support, and I thought, well, why don't I get the Urban League and the Sierra Club to get together and do some works, projects in my neighborhood? So I went to the Sierra Club, and I talked to the neighbor, the outreach person, and I said, look, could we meet and discuss this idea with the Urban League? And she says, well, what is the Urban League? She did not know what the Urban League was, and she's the outreach coordinator for the Sierra Club. On the other hand, I went to the Urban League, and they said, oh, it's a very important issue, but it's not on our agenda. And so we've come so far to find that the Sierra Club is probably the main leader in this new coalition, and working, of course, with all these others, including, of course, the NAACP. But so I think we have an exciting opportunity to do something new.
And you're talking about bringing it even more to the neighborhood level. Well, I just wanted to say that I think the community radio and some of the more alternative newspapers in the town could facilitate that, do a lot more reporting and help link people up. So I don't know. We'll see where that goes. Thank you so much for calling in. We got another caller.
I'll see you soon.
Okay, and that was Ross from the Woodlawn neighborhood. And if you wrote down his number, you can call him up and get involved in Woodlawn. We got Ken, you're probably our last caller. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to say about recount. It's very instructive to go look up the history of Jill Stein, who requested a recount in three states, and the secretaries of state in those respective states required her to post something like $100,000 or something to do the recount, and then they closed down the recount. So it's worthwhile taking a look at the history here.
And another thing, just to, on that note, that I noticed that the Georgia voters filed suit just yesterday to actually prevent Kemp from overseeing like a recount or the whole election result process. So if it does come to that, it'll be really interesting. There's two big things. Well, Kemp is still, he's still Secretary of State, which is just insane. And will he be able to stay in that position and oversee whatever the process comes out? That's a very interesting situation.
Yeah, well, I should say in regard to the power of the Secretaries of State, remember that Kathleen Harris, Catherine Harris, was the Secretary of State of Florida when George Bush had the recount, and they disenfranchised hundreds of thousands of voters in that particular instance. Now, years ago, someone on KABU interviewed a woman by the name of Emily Brozinski, in which she outlines the unbelievable powers that the secretaries of state have over the integrity of the voting process. And if you or anybody else who's interested in this can look up Emily Grosinski and find out where she is and get her to have her be interviewed again on KABU, it would be very instructive.
Okay, I just wrote that name down. And we are flush out of time, Ken. So
yeah, okay. Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for calling. And we got to run. This has been an interesting discussion of various aspects of the election. And thank you very much for listening. And stay tuned to, I believe, Lisa Loving is up next. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO.
There's a new sun
sky, and there's a new voice crying, we're not afraid to die. Let the old world make believe it's blind and deaf and dumb, but nothing can change the shape of things to come. There are changes lying ahead.
In radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee. Top Dog Underdog tells the story of a sibling rivalry between African-American brothers in a turbulent relationship punctuated with dark humor. Their names are Lincoln and Booth. This show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, you're